Okay, good Erev Shabbos, everybody. So I believe we are up to session number 7 in the Chasson Shmooz You Wish You Had But Never Had. And I'd like to think, Be'ezras Hashem, that we're fulfilling our mandate and we really are talking about things that you might not hear elsewhere. Again, it's important to remind people of some of the ground rules of this year. First of all, it's very important if you're listening to this as a recording afterwards that you do it in order, that each year builds on the other. There's very important details, and sometimes we may review something quickly, but without having had the foundation that we built from this year before, it could lead people to misunderstanding. This is not a halacha shir. I'm not a posik. I will tell you different gemaras or Jewish sources and give them to you from what I understand, but I'm not qualified to paskin. It's also important, again, to say this because as we continue in these shiurim, the content is going to get even deeper in terms of sexual practice and inyanim bein ish leishto, and it really should be understood that this is a very unusual thing to do, and that it's essentially a hara shah. I think that people that have been on the internet and have seen all the horrible things, I don't think that a shir that deals with the positive aspects of sexuality is, within that context, a breach of tznius. But really, in principle, it is a breach of tznius, and that it's important to understand that, that we're doing this as a harash show that I do believe people really do need to hear about and learn these things. If anybody has any questions, they're welcome to text to 718-793-1376. That's 718-793-1376. You can also email to simchafeuerman@gmail.com, simchafeuerman@gmail.com. So last week, we were continuing this theme that was based on a number of requests about individuals who were in relationships where they felt that their wife was not as interested in being sexual, seemed to be reluctant. In some of the emails, there are very extreme cases where there was a lot of reluctance and disinterest in sex, and in other cases, in some of the emails I received, it was more that it was not enough or frequent, etc., and that we talked about different approaches, and we're continuing that along that theme. But at the end of last year, somebody had asked if I would review, because I named a bunch of strategies, and actually, I think I only, even though I said there were 6 or 7, I think I only had 5 when I looked back and reviewed them, but I will very quickly review them. One is to ask with a real open mind to really hear what seems to be the problem in a respectful, not in a shaming or blaming way, but say, I notice that you're not as interested as I am or as you used to be or as which seems to be what people do, and help me understand, and to listen and not to argue, and to take in everything you hear and spend a good period of time, a month or two, working on addressing that identified need. And even if that identified need is not the whole story, oftentimes when you solve one thing, it sets into motion a certain kind of momentum that produces change anyway. We also spoke about, that was number one. Number two, we spoke about the fear that some women experience about being pressured into sex short circuits what is really a natural arousal pattern of the pleasure of touching, meaning that most people, if they're touched and held, become aroused. But if you feel that the touching and being held is a precursor to an inevitable sexual experience that you're not necessarily welcoming, then the touching and being held doesn't feel good either, because the anxiety starts rising, and anxiety short circuits arousal. So a ruach has to be created where the feeling is that the touching and the being held is not an automatic precursor to sex and is not a pressure for sex. And if somehow or another one can create that zone by discussing it, by explaining it, by saying that holding each other is important. We showed Makaros and Chazal for this, that then the natural process of being aroused might very well take over. We spoke about another strategy was that anything that does occur that's positive, notice it and praise it. So if you're being held a certain way and that feels good, or being touched a certain way, be effusive about, oh, that really feels good. Oh, that's so wonderful. It makes me feel close to you when you do that, etc. Because, again, building the positive is much more effective than criticizing the negative. And in strategy number four, we spoke about how oftentimes the result of a lot of controlling behavior is a passive-aggressive retreat. And so the people that feel controlled in their lives, that feel dominated and certainly controlled in their sexual life, the result might be a conscious or unconscious retreat from sexual availability in a passive-aggressive way of maintaining some sense of control. A retaliatory sense of control. So you really have to look at the patterns of power in your relationship and how collaborative your relationship is and how much freedom your spouse feels in your presence, because, again, being controlled is a very strong inhibitor of arousal under ordinary circumstances. Now, people that have different fantasies or whatever, which is another story, but generally speaking, people do not want to be controlled. And we started to speak about last week the very important basic function of making sure that your wife experiences pleasure, because if the sexual process is only partially arousing and then she's left frustrated, and a lot of times people are not honest about that because they don't want to make anybody feel bad, or they feel ashamed or guilty of having that kind of need, so you really have to listen very carefully. But when that happens, this becomes an unconscious avoidance and disappointment with being sexual. And last week we started to do a Gemara Nida and Daf Lamed Aleph, Amud Aleph and Amud Beis, that talks about the importance of what's being called Shohe Al HaBeten, which means to be able to, literally it means to delay on the stomach, but it means that to be able to engage in intercourse for a long period of time and not too quickly, because it is very pleasurable and fulfilling for a woman under normal circumstances if she is properly aroused, which is very important. If she is properly aroused and there's the right amount of what you would call in Hebrew pius, but I'm not going to rely on Hebrew. In English you would call it foreplay. Then the actual sexual experience is very fulfilling and very arousing for them, and they want it for a long time. I also mentioned that I really can't give all the details over in a shir because there's a lot of particular psychological and behavioral circumstances, but I do take a very strong stand for people to understand that a man's ejaculation is completely under his control. It doesn't feel that way, and many people feel struggle with the ability to engage in intercourse for a long enough period of time that would work for their spouse, and it's because of different behavioral and psychological issues, and it is absolutely fixable and treatable, and any man can learn how to manage and control when he's moitzi zera during intercourse. And it's a very important skill because it's very meaningful for a woman, for a man to be engaged for a long period of time when she's sufficiently aroused. So I can't give over all the details because, as I said, there really are a lot of particulars in each person's situation. It's a complex web of behavioral and psychological factors that contribute to a man's ability to be able to sustain intercourse without being moti zera. And so it's just, I can only give over some very general ideas, which is that the pace at which you go about the activity can have a very big impact. For example, you don't have to do everything at the same speed, at the same moment, at the same position, and oftentimes switching and entering more slowly, and all those things have a very big impact. Sometimes just changing the pattern can change how you feel. Also, remember, being shoah al habeten, the Talmudic definition means to be able to engage in the act of intercourse for as long as possible. That Talmudic definition may include many things other than just being yotze v'nichnas, other than just thrusting. So you can remain still inside her and hold her for a long period of time, or make smaller movements. Now, there are issues. There are positions or ways of maneuvering that bring a woman more or less pleasure, and there needs to be some collaborative discussion, because sometimes it's not a matter of how fast you go, but it's a matter of exactly which position you're in, and it may be possible to move in a very slight way that doesn't arouse the man too much that he has to be motzi zera, and at the same time is able to meet the woman's need. But all this really requires a lot of discussion. Now, there's an interesting Gemara in Sota on Daf Daladam and Aleph, and this one's my chiddush. I don't know anybody that says this. The Gemara in Sota goes into a whole discussion of what exactly is considered what's called ha'ara'a. Ha'ara'a is a Talmudic term for the beginning moment of intercourse, and there's a machlokas exactly what it is. But let's just say, for the purposes of this discussion, it is just the beginning of the entry of the man's aver into the woman. And that's called ha'ara. And that's when ha'ara is achieved, that's already considered intercourse halachically for many violations. And so the Gemara in Sota has to figure out what's the minimum amount of time that a woman is alone that she's considered violating the principle of being alone if she's warned that she can't be alone with another man. And it's the amount of time that it takes to achieve ha'ara, that first moment of entry. And so the Gemara then goes on to discuss in a really kind of bizarre way the different Tanoim described their definition of that length of time. So Rabbi Lezer Omer, Kedei Mezigas HaKos, the amount of time it takes to pour a cup of wine. Actually, it's not to pour a cup of wine. In the ancient times, the wine was a heavy concentrate, and then they added water. So really, Mezigas HaKos means to blend the water with the wine concentrate. Rabbi Yeshua Omer, Kedei Lishtoso. Rabbi Yeshua says, obviously, I would think a shorter amount of time, how long it takes to drink it. Benazi Omer, Kedei Litzlos Beitza. Benazi says the amount of time it takes to fry an egg. Rabbi Kiva Omer, Kedei Lagoma, the amount of time it takes to swallow an egg. Rabbi Yehuda ben Beseira Omer, Kedei Lagomor, Shalosh Beitzim, Zoach Razu, the amount of time it takes to eat three eggs. Rabbi Lezer ben Yirmi Omer, Kedei Likshor Gar Deinima, the amount of time it takes to tie the warp and the woof on the loom. What's interesting is that they're going into great in detail discussing this shear. You really don't need to give all these different amounts. Rashi over there comments, Kol echavecha min hachamim halolu ba'atzmo shirer, each one of the chachamim on their own estimated kama shehu shoh b'ha'aroso, how long he delays in his ha'ara'a, how long he takes to do the ha'ara'a. Now, literally, Rashi's just explaining the length of time, and each Tana is telling you their length of time for Ha'ara. But I do believe, you know, the Chachamim were very tzniyas, and they didn't oftentimes speak about any Torah thing explicitly, and certainly about matters of tzniyas, they spoke in innuendo and remez. And I find two fascinating points over here. I find it fascinating that these Tanoim would go into great detail to explain, which seems to be, relatively speaking, probably almost identical shiurim compared to the Gemara in Brachas, I think, in the beginning of Brachas on Daf Beis and Beis, where they go through, you know, what's the Kadesh Yakir, what's the time that's in the earliest time to say Kriya Shema, and there's all these different shiurim, and they're pretty much the same. So the Gemara is going into all this, and Rashi uses that key word there, kama shehu shoha, how long he delays in his ha'ara. And I think that there may be a hint here that conceptually, shoha alabetan is not only in the act of intercourse, what one would consider classically being yotzev and nichnas, the thrusting and the in and out, but being shoha is even at the beginning of entry, to go very slow, and even to wait at that moment, and that is a part of being shoha alabetan, and that's a part of extending intercourse. Now that's a very good idea, because if you do that, a couple of things happen. Number one, you're slowing down your own arousal process because you're not doing a lot of heavy movement or contact, so that you're basically scaling back your arousal, which is important if you want to be able to extend the intercourse, and at the same time, the teasing of being in a position where the wife is potentially about to get something but is not getting it yet or only getting it partially is in and of itself very arousing, that teasing. Now, teasing in a sexual fashion is something that the Gemara recognizes as a very important strategy. The Gemara in Shabbos on Daf Kuf Mem Amud Beis talks about Benasei de Rav Chisda. Rav Chisda advised his daughters something. Now, I'll translate it literally because you first have to understand that there are many interpretations to this Gemara. So you first have to know the literal meaning. We're going to go with Rashi's explanation. But the Gemara itself says, this is what Rav Chisda would advise his daughters. Nakat marganisa b'chada yode, put the pearl, put the jewel in one hand, the kura b'chada yode, and put the gold vessel or something in the other hand. Marganisa achvilahu. Oh, actually, kura might be the furnace. Put the furnace in one hand and put the pearl, the jewel, in the other hand. Marganisa achvilahu. Show him the pearl. The kura lo achvilahu. Do not show him the furnace. Adamitzdaran. Until he's in agony. V'hoda achvilahu, and then show it to them. So that's the literal translation. Here's how Rashi explains it. Rashi says, Kishabalich mishamshich biyad lis'avas lach, when your husband is feeling you in order to desire you, l'tashmish, V'ochis hadodim biyodo achas, and he's holding on to the breasts with one hand. V'acheres al osamakom, and his hand is on that other place. In other words, the woman's private area, right? Marganisa achvenle, hadodin hamsi ilo, allow him to have access to the breasts. Shetisraba tavoso, that he'll have a lot of taiva. Umkom tashmish al tamsi ilo, but don't give him easy access to the place of intercourse, maher, quickly, kideshi yisrabata vaso v'chibaso, so that his arousal will increase and his affection will increase, v'yitzdar, and he'll be in agony, but, you know, in a good way, as the saying goes, hurts so good, right? That there's a tremendous desire, Hoder achvelai, and then when he's all revved up, then give him access. That's Rashi's understanding of Rav Chisda's advice to his daughters. I would say that Rav Chisda's daughters were pretty fortunate, and so were their husbands. Now, you see from here, though, that there's a tremendous value to teasing and holding back. So if you apply this in the reverse to the case of Hahara, right, you could, at the moment of entry, instead of just continuing, pause right there and engage in some kind of intimate teasing behavior, which would physically reduce your arousal to an extent because you're not in the same contact as full intercourse, but probably increase her arousal. So that's possibly what Rashi over there in Sota was hinting at in terms of being Shoha, that that's a case of Shoha ala Betan too. It's my own Chiddush. It may not be what Rashi is saying or what the Gemara is saying. However, psychologically, it's quite valid. Now, the Gemara also, over there in Nida, on Lamed Aleph, Amud Aleph and Beis, says that another option is to be Baal Vashona, is to repeat intercourse, which, of course, some people might find very difficult to do because they're no longer aroused. One could argue that would be the greatest mitzvah of Lishma, to be able to do that, right? It would be a great, because here, even when you're not feeling so much arousal, and you're doing it only to please your wife, that would be a wonderful thing. Also, keep in mind that it's not just repeating intercourse. Holding and hugging and having all kinds of intimate contact after intercourse also is very pleasing for the woman because it makes her feel valued beyond your pleasure. Women catch on pretty quickly that after the man is moti zera, he doesn't feel a lot of desire at that point. So at that point, a man continues to engage in a lot of affection. It's delivering an extremely strong psychological message that you are valued for more than sex, and that's going to have a tremendous impact in the future. So it's a big investment. And then the other way around, if it's not done right, it's going to lead to a lot of difficulty. And I quoted last week a fascinating Bracious Rabbah, Parsha Yud Tes, where Bracious Rabbah basically asks, where was Adam when the Nachash was talking to Chava and making all the trouble? And the Midrash Rabbah says he fell asleep after having intercourse, and he disappeared on her. And that's a criticism. So you don't want to do that. You don't want to leave your wife abandoned afterward. Now, I'm going to have time to begin another strategy today, and it's actually going to open up a whole sugya, a very complicated sugya, but the strategy is relatively simple, which is that another wonderful way to increase arousal and increase a person's interest in being sexual is actually to have fun and loosen up and even use a sense of humor. I'm hesitant to talk to addicts about drinking because sometimes people are multiply addicted. But it's also true that people have different triggers, and one person could drink no problem, but be addicted to a different process. So if drinking is not a trigger for you, having a little bit to drink is also, it's a good thing, and it helps people loosen up, having fun. Now it's very interesting, and I can't believe it's an accident. In Bracious Chaf Vav Pasuk Ches, when it describes that Avimelech spied on Yitzchak and Rivka and realized that they were married, but the words that the Torah uses to describe their intimate behavior, it says, Vayar v'hinei Yitzchak mitzachek es Rivka ishto. Yitzchak was laughing, was playing with his wife. And that's the word, not all the Mepharshim learned that they were having intercourse, but some do. And that's a word that they're using to describe being sexual, as tzchok, as fun, as laughter. So that tells you that that's an aspect of intercourse. And even more powerfully, The Gemara in Brachas, Samach Bezimet Aleph, discusses how Rav Kahana was a very devoted Talmud of Rav, and Rav Kahana would follow Rav everywhere. And so he decided he wanted to understand how his Rebbe conducts himself intimately with his wife. So he follows him, and he hides under the bed. Different Mefarshim try to figure out what in the world he really did, because it would seem to be a violation of Tznias. But let's learn the Pashim Shat. Rav Kahana al Gana Tusei Puri the Rav. Rav Kahana lay underneath the bed of Rav. Shamei Desach. He heard him talking to his wife, Besachaken. He was laughing with her, Vasatzrachov, and then he, you know, engaged in intercourse. See, he couldn't believe it. So he challenged his Rebbe, Omale, Dami Pumi Da Abba Kidulo Sarif Tavshila. My Abba was Rav's name, so he called him by his first name, which is interesting. But you know, it looks like you never ate in your life, that you were, you know, ravenously hungry, meaning he was engaging, apparently he was engaging in sex with great fervor and gusto, apparently. So Rav obviously is mortified that his Talmud is in his bedroom. So Amrlei Kana, Hacha'at, Kana, you are here? Poke! Get out, the lava orach ara. This is not derech eretz for you to be in your Rebbe's bedroom. Omer lo, he said to him, Toruhi v'lumod anitzorach. Rav Kahana's answer, and by the way, there's no rebuttal from Rav, which is interesting. Rav Kahana's answer is that it's Torah. I have to learn it. And I guess that's my answer here. If anybody has a problem with what we're talking about, if it's Torah, we also have to talk about it. Now, Rashi there says, Sach v'sachak, he talked and he laughed and he engaged in levity. Im ishto, sich b'tela, he spoke idle chatter. Shel ritzoi tashmish, of appeasement. You know, so he kibitzed with her, he let her talk, he did whatever it took to make her feel more aroused and more interested. V'asa tzrachav, v'shimish mitaso. And he had sex, and that's what Rashi says. Kidlo sarf tafshila, ka'adam roiv, like a starving man, kamoshal shemashtam mitaschal yolam, as if you never engaged in sex before. Shata noe kalash rosh del tavoscha. You're engaging in this kalash rosh, in this levity, to fulfill your taiva. The Rambam in Hilchos Ishus, Perek Tezvav, Halacha Zayin, mentions that one should engage in intercourse, mitoch sicha v'simcha, through talking, again, words of engagement and love and flattery and compliments, v'simcha, and joy. So as a strategy, it's certainly valid to use humor and levity and having a good time to loosen things up. Now, this brings us, and B'li Neder Be'ezus Hashem, next week we're going to begin a much more complex parsha about this, but this brings us to a latent question that I think many of you are having, because clearly the focus on many of these Gemaras are about giving pleasure to the woman. And the question is, what about the man's pleasure? Is there any value in the man having pleasure? And what's the Torah's opinion about that? And who's obligated in what? And that is a very, very complex sugya, which I hope that we get to, because it's very important for a Jewish man not only to know his responsibilities and not only to know what he's obligated and what his prohibitions are, but to also understand what are his rights and what are his basic human needs, and how does the Torah ask us to deal with it? What does the Torah expect? So I hope to cover that next week. I'm just going to shut off the recording. Hold on a moment.